A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello and welcome to The Delicious Podcast with me, Jilly Smith. And this week I'm in a busy restaurant celebrating Christmas with Rick Stein. His latest book, Secret France, was surely in every food lover's stocking this year. And the TV series of the book has been reminding us what we love most about French cooking. I asked him, of all the secrets he's found, what can't he do without at Christmas?
Well, actually, it might seem odd, but it wouldn't be Christmas without sparkling Shiraz. And the reason for that is that I developed a taste for sparkling Shiraz years and years ago with my then wine merchant, Bill Baker, who sadly died. But he reckoned that sparkling Shiraz was one of the best and most original wines out of Australia. So every year I open a bottle or two at Christmas, and my boys, my sons, fail to see the point of it. Although my youngest son, Charlie, who's in the wine business, is beginning to get it. But year after year I persevered, and some of the sparkling Shiraz now is really quite venerable, because it's been in my cellar, which is actually the garage in Padstow, for as much as 10 years, and it ages perfectly. But also, having a sparkling red, a young sparkling red at a party, it's something that's really lovely to drink.
And is it one of those drinks that you would have as you're having your starters, your little canapés, or is it something that cuts through a particular dish that you make at Christmas?
It's really good with your starters, but really when I serve it, it's just before Christmas lunch. You know, you can have champagne or sparkling Shiraz.
Yeah.
Most people say, oh, I don't like the sound of that. But once you got into it, it's all over. You just have to have it on any festive occasion. But also, it's quite cheap still, because people don't really get how lovely it is.
Well, somebody else suggested cider brandy.
Yes.
Instead of Prosecco. So get away from the cheap bubbles, but go for cider brandy from Somerset Cider Brandy.
I love Somerset Cider Brandy, but it's a bit strong to start your Christmas lunch with.
Crikey. Over once.
We once filmed at the Somerset Cider Brandy place. Lovely drink, but maybe not for as a precursor to Christmas lunch.
Now, nice segue into Northern France there. We're talking today about your book,
yeah.
Your Secret France, and I'm very excited about this. It feels very nostalgic for me. It feels like you've gone back into a time when French cooking was our kind of entry into food, into loving food, the depths of the flavours, the nuance, layers. You've done a trip through France before, but this is through your Secret France. Let's start at the top, when you were 16, with that first visit that set off this love of France.
Well, yes, I mean, that's what I look back to, was going to France. Actually, I was sent over there by my parents and my sister to northern France. And it was the first time, I guess you've got to be about 16. Actually, I think I was 14 the first time and 16 the second, because we went twice, me and Henrietta. But what was so special about it was we were staying in a chateau owned by a sort of farmer that had a 3,000 hectare estate, making, growing sugar beet, petit pois, and haricot vert. And the chateau was extraordinary, mostly for us, because they had a butler and full staff who served us every day. And I don't think either myself or my sister had ever experienced such wonderful food. Needless to say, when we got home, we were telling my mother how wonderful it was. She was a bit put out, but
was it the performance around food? A lot of people who say, you know, when they were 8, 9, 10, when they had that first experience of silver service or something, it's the taking off of the lid, the great display, the great theatre of food.
That's a very good point, Jenny, because I think the French always have a... One of the great things about the French is their sense of performance with all food. I mean, I remember once having a canteen lunch at the cookery school at the Tech in Birmingham, where Michel Roux Sr. and I were judging a competition. And they served d'Aubusson, which is very nice of them, in the canteen, in the staff canteen. But Michel made a big... Oh, God. And they served d'Aubusson, which was very nice of them. But Michel made a big occasion out of it. He called for a salad. He called for a glass of wine. He sat down and he contemplated the fish. And then he dissected it and he filleted it perfectly. And all the time I was thinking, this is so French. So really, for me and my sister, having a butler serving the food with white gloves, pouring the cider with white gloves, was something really new and exotic to us.
Well, it blows your mind a little bit, doesn't
Absolutely.
It? It resets your experience, and then you start getting excited by it. You then talk in the book about, you revisit that memory beautifully at the beginning of the book, and you talk about the actual ingredients, and the ingredients from Brittany in particular, the shellfish.
Well, I mean, the French have always been really good with shellfish and with fish. I mean, it's true to say that it's always been in Paris. You can always get just as good fish in Paris and shellfish. Think of those little seafood bars everywhere in Paris, as you can on the coast, which hasn't really been the same in this country. I think generally, I mean, fish is probably the best example, but generally, food in markets, in shops in France is so wonderful and still so wonderful that through the book I have been a little bit critical about some of the cooking in French restaurants, but nobody can ever deny that French food in markets is just second to none.
And it's interesting what you say is that's because of the market stallholders. They still have this generations of knowledge. It's not just love, it's skill and real understanding of foods. You mentioned the great Alice Waters, and you don't think that if she were to have her French adventure as she did in the 1960s, early 70s, she would come away with that same feeling. But the way that you talk about those producers in the market stalls, which is where she fell in love with food, they still have it, don't they?
Well, they do still have it. And I think you're absolutely right. It is part of a tradition. And it is part of a deal between the market stall traders and the public and the customers, because the customers traditionally have always known what they're looking for, much more, I suspect, discerning than many British people in markets, and therefore it's been a sort of cooperation between customer and stallholder. I sort of suspect that this is breaking down a little bit, because one of the things that we did pick up, and I may not have made a big deal out of it, is that last time I filmed in France for French Odyssey, which was like at the beginning, yeah, probably about 2005. I remember on one of the two barges we were going down the Canal du Midi with, he was English, a guy called Lee, but he spoke perfect French. He said, I don't understand why you're making this program. Nobody needs cookery programs in France. We all know how to cook. These days, there's lots of cookery programs in France, and I think that whole understanding, knowledge passed down from grandmothers and mothers to daughters is passing, and therefore there is a sort of, I think, a breakdown in sort of, I think it will happen in markets as well, and people knowing what they're buying and demanding the best.
Yeah, I mean, you say that you think that there's still some good cooking, lots of good cooking going on in the homes, but not in the restaurants. And it was really surprising to me that you said that, you know, all over France you find finished meals, meals made in industrial estates being shipped into the restaurants. Really?
Well, it was extraordinary to me, because actually we were in the Uzès, which is... probably you've been there, but a beautiful town on the border between Provence and Roussillon. And I was particularly keen on the fig tart. I'd done the recipe for it in the book, partly because the middle of the fig tart was still moist, still baveuse, as the French say. And I sort of got the waiter over and I said, this is wonderful. And she said, oh, yeah, well, it comes in frozen, so it's probably not defrosted. It was only just defrosted. And then you sort of make inquiries, and so much stuff is bought in. But you can understand why, because you know, cooking wages are high, and the French have a very high sort of social security requirements that, you know, you only work 35-hour weeks, and you can only, you know, there's a maximum that you can work. So staff are expensive and in short supply. So it's sort of breaking down a little bit.
And of course we find this in Spain and Italy as well. You know, that the whole culture is changing because of the way that animals are farmed. There's a lot of factory farming. I mean, you do talk about the cattle of Burgundy.
Of Charolais, yeah.
As one of your secrets that you can't... We'll come to that in a second. But actually, you know, my experience of France is that, you know, if you take the Eurostar, for example, you don't see a lot of animals out to pasture. You found them. Is the culture still alive and well?
Well, I think, to be honest, you have to go out and find them. And I think that more than ever, you need good food guides. And to be honest, if you're looking for restaurants, there's no better good food guide than the Michelin guide. I've sort of been a bit critical about the sort of 2 and 3 star because of the sort of aspirations of the chefs and what they turn up. But in terms of a sort of bog standard guide of what is good, it's fine.
Yeah.
But you do need that. And so you can't expect to go to a small French town and find those sort of restaurants that maybe you would have done in the 70s or 80s, early 90s, and just go in and marvel about it, because it's just not like the sort of family cooking place is much rarer. But it's the same all over Europe. It's the same in this country as well, actually.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, one of the sort of conclusions I came to was it's not so much that French cooking has gone downhill so far, it's that we've gone uphill so far, that we now expect so much more. And, you know, you have mentioned Alice Waters. Would she experience the same thing now? No, she probably wouldn't, but she'd be looking for different parts of the world. She'd be looking in sort of Thailand or anywhere in Southeast Asia. She'd probably been to somewhere like Tbilisi in Georgia, or, you know, people are very much more outward looking, going to different places. So the other thing that's sort of quite noticeable in France is how little, relative to the UK, they've embraced the cuisines of other countries.
What do you think that is? It's the same in Italy and largely Spain as well. You don't find Chinese, you don't find Indian. You do in the capitals, but not generally in the countryside.
That's correct. And I think it's really because they believe in their own cuisine, and they quite, I suppose you could say arrogantly, both Italians and French, believe their cuisine is special and
but also identifies them.
And identifies them. I mean, it's funny, in the beginning of the programme, I'm actually saying, you know, food in France is not just, I would say something like, not just the most important thing in life, it is life itself, because sometimes the way they carry on, it is. But they're sort of like, somehow they need to sort of pick a few new ideas on board. One of the things that I'm sort of like very pleased with in the series, but I think I could have done better, is to just highlight young people in restaurants. I mean, we've done a couple, which is really rewarding, but I wish I'd done a bit more, because very often when you find you're having a really good, simple meal in France, most of the staff will be under 30, and they do have this sort of, like, tremendous sort of, like, let's get back to our proper cuisine and doing it properly.
Yeah? Yes, I was surprised that you said that. I mean, I find a lot of the young chefs in London are very motivated, and of course from Australia and New Zealand. That's how we got the good food in Australia, in London.
True.
By the Australian and New Zealand's taking their OE, their overseas experience, in, you know, all over the world, and then bringing it to London. I wouldn't have thought that of the French. I don't see a lot of French travellers in the same way.
Well, it's true, there are fewer, but I do think it's changing. I mean, after all, you quite rightly say that Australia led the way. Now we've caught up, of course. But I do see sort of elements of that in France. I mean, yeah, they don't travel as much as us, or they don't seem to. But there are sort of ideas coming through which clearly indicate people are travelling. But still, what they want to do their local food. I mean, there's just one. Unfortunately, we didn't film in Paris because David Pritchard, who sadly died during the making of the series, didn't like filming in cities. Fine, it's his show, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But what one of my ex chefs, Ollie Clark, is the head chef of a place called La Régalade in Paris, and I really wanted to go there because he's like in his mid early 30s. He's cooking French food. You go into La Régalade with him as head chef. First thing you get when you sit down is a great big tureen of pate and a great big bowl of gherkins of what do they call them, cornichons, right? And that's just the bread comes up, and that's just for you to be sort of like, you know.
That's so interesting because, you know, that's quite different to what the young people are doing in this country. What it feels like you're saying is that there's a return to the traditional values, the traditional, forget the arrogance for a moment, maybe pride in who, what French cooking is. I mean, I'm just thinking, where does that lead us? Say, what will French food look like in 10 years' time?
It's so difficult to predict that, but I sense that these sort of young people are not wanting to throw the baby out with the bathwater. They understand that their cuisine has a lot of strength to it, and they're playing with that, but they will bring in new ideas as well.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like, it's an exciting place to go to now, really. I mean, I was talking to somebody the other day about Paris, and they said you could make a program in Paris, a whole series in Paris with what's going on there now. And the last two times I've been there, and I'm actually going next month, it's so exciting. And I don't think, if you just stuck to Paris, I don't think you'd be saying that French food is stuck, you know?
I'm not saying it's stuck. I'm saying that it is very stable, actually. I mean, yeah. I think I have a theory that there are stable food cultures, French, Spanish, Italian, South American, you know, Mexican, Chile. I mean, all the places where you've been, basically, all stable food cultures. They've been the same for a very, very long time. Then there are the unstable food cultures, Britain, America, Australia, where we've had a blank canvas to play with the amazing flavours from all over the world, because we were boring, we weren't adventurous, and then through migrants coming in and bringing their flavours with them is about pride and identity.
Well, I agree, but I don't think the British food, I think we always perceived it as being bad, but I don't think it was.
It wasn't hundreds of years ago.
No, you're absolutely right, and I think, I mean, about, like, I don't know, 12, 15 years ago, I did a programme called Food Heroes. We went round the UK finding actually great produce, not so much great cooking. But during the course of that, we found some great cooking. And just after that, I did the French Odyssey. And I just sort of felt that I think what the French are really good at, and we're not so good at, is actually selling their local cuisine, right? And if you look at something like the Cornish pasty now, which was regarded, like, in the 80s as being the most dire and drear food that you could imagine, mainly because on the whole it was, that it's been sort of resurrected by certain people, and it is perceived, to be quite rightly, a great pie. And the same with many other dishes. I just remember going, doing a Japanese programme years ago. I met a Japanese ambassador. I'd been filming in Padstow, going out on a fishing boat, mackerel fishing, and I prepared some sashimi from the mackerel they'd just caught. And it was a bit of a sort of like, the director said, well, a lot of them are going to refuse to eat it because it's like revolting eating raw fish, and that's duly what happened. And the other half said, fabulous. And anyway, I met the ambassador at some do in the city a week or two later, and he'd seen the programme, and he just said, you've made a big mistake, you can't serve raw mackerel because it's got a parasite in, which it has in Japan but not here. And I sort of said, well, you know, I don't really understand about sashimi, I'm so sorry. And I went back and said to David about it, and he said, I've got an idea, why don't we go to Japan and find out about how to make sashimi. And during the course of talking to the ambassador, he said, I really like British food. I like going out at the weekend. I like fish and chips, fish pie, steak and kidney pudding, and he wasn't sort of like being polite to me. He really enjoyed going out to pubs and finding good stuff, and I suddenly thought, hang on, we're missing a point here. And when you go to some like regional Italy or France, a lot of their sort of regional dishes are no better or no worse than ours. It's just that we've always had this sort of slight, you know, inferiority complex, I suspect.
After the break, we talk about the legacy of the legend behind both Rick and Keith Floyd, director, fellow bon viveur, and Rick's great friend, David Pritchard.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Let's talk a little bit about David Pritchard.
Right.
Now, he was your friend and your director for 30 years. He was probably the king of food television in was the director for Keith Floyd, of course, where you first appeared
in
1985.
84.
What a legend. It must have been very sad for you. Did you write the book after you'd finished the tour, or were you writing it all along?
No, I wrote it after I'd finished the tour. And I mean, I started it before he died, but finished it after. So, yes, it was. And, I mean, the series is still very much his, because it was his idea to travel off the beaten track through France. And the whole idea of the journey was, as he said, in his totally original way, let's just think of the mark of Zorro, like it's a sort of squiggle with the end of a sword through France. So we sort of like got no particular reason for where we go, except that most of the places are not as well visited by British people as other parts. But basically it was his sort of like nostalgia for just motoring through France in the sort of 70s or 80s. That's how he saw it. And I think to a certain extent it was sort of like, you know, he knew he was going to go, I think, and just sort of like put himself in a place where he remembered very fondly about. But the thing is, in doing that, he kindled the same memory in me. And, you know, I mean, I suppose there's other places in Europe where the cooking is perceived to be sort of better, which is, I'm thinking of Italy particularly. But I mean, for me, French cooking, and for David, was where we started, really. And that was the first sort of great sort of revelation about sort of how to cook really lovely foods and how to drink really nice wine with it as well.
Was it with you, or was it with Keith Floyd when he drew a map of France?
It was with me,
on the tablecloth.
Yeah, that was the first trip. It was in
and delivered the tablecloth to the commissioning editor and said, commission this.
And it was nice, because, well, he said maybe a little bit of A4 with it, you know, it would be a bit more formal. But I think it's sort of, in a way, we like to use that as well, both David and I, as an example of how sort of bureaucracy threatens the BBC, you know, because in those days we would like to think that they'd back us on a whim, but I think it was actually that particular Tom Archer, the particular commissioning editor at the time, just had a, you know, he just had the...
Because that was the spirit of the programme, wasn't it? Yeah. It was very sort of, you know, David was the first person. It's always attributed to Keith Floyd, but it was actually David who was a bit more postmodern about the use of the camera, made it a character.
Well, I really liked David's Shooting the Cook, which was a book of which you might have read, but it was about how him and Keith developed this whole sort of blokey way, and like the way he bossed the cameraman around. And it wasn't sort of one or the other. They just were in this situation where, you know, it was sort of a bit, you know, contrary to what Delia Smith was doing at the time. It had to be absolutely us boys being naughty, drinking too much and being rude about, you know, French cooks.
So I try and cook up a couple of recipes, at least before I talk to the food writer. And I chose the brill with sepp and chestnuts and found myself making a pork confit. And I thought, God, only with French cooking would you make a pork confit to make fish.
Well, the thing about the pork confit in there is actually, if you're in the Dordogne, you can buy it in jars.
My dogs rather loved the fact that I was making it.
It's, I know, it's a bit tricky, that one. But, I mean, I've tried to keep the book... You know,
It's really not. I mean, you lay it out, you lay bits of pork on a tray, and you put salt on them for 6 hours. That's...
Yeah.
Well, and then you bake it.
It does work very, very well. I mean, the use of pork, the pork skin like that, I sort of came across years ago, and we had loads of pork skin because I was cooking hams actually for the deli, right? So we had all this skin because we used to, you know, strip the skin off and then stud them with cloves and roast them, or finish off with marmalade or brown sugar. So I had all this skin, and I started tasting it, and also I was experimenting with pig's trotters at the time, thanks to Pierre Kaufman, you know. And I just thought that actually the skin of pork is so wonderfully gelatinous. So I've done a few dishes like that where I've worked it into a sauce.
Yes, there was the bean stew as
well. Yeah, yeah.
Which I was surprised about because, of course...
And that was a traditional French dish. But it's actually, that's really interesting because that bean stew was one of those sort of epiphany moments for me, because when we were eating it, and she was a woman that had a walnut and hazelnut oil mill, I just thought, this is what French food at its best is all about. Having a sort of, to us, slightly wacky ingredient like pork skin, which just makes it taste so special.
Oh, absolutely.
And you couldn't sort of really explain that to people generally. It's like the other thing I found was when we were in, what's it called? Le Quatuor in Picardy. We had this lamb in hay cooked there, the salt marsh lamb from the Bay of the Somme, and he cooked it so rare that it was like practically raw in the middle, right? And it was lovely, but I was thinking, you could serve this up to English people, British people, in his restaurant in Le Quatuor, and they'd be sensational. You put that on a menu in in anywhere in the UK, and they'd say it's raw.
Yeah, it's absolutely fascinating. Right, a couple of questions from Instagrammers. Yeah. So Tori Vickerman wants to know, what's your favourite region
in France? Well, I'd say on balance, I mean, I'm quite keen in this series on the Auvergne, but I think from sort of great memories, it's actually Jura near Burgundy, between Burgundy and the Pyrenees, just simply because it's. You remember that book called Le Grand Moan, you know, which is like a sort of like ideal
Vaseline
lens picture of France. Well, Jura's a bit like that, because you can't believe how beautiful it is and how relatively untouched it is by tourists. And everywhere you go, there's like the most dreamy villages and fantastic chateaus with tiny tiles. And so I really like that. I also like the wine of Jura, which people don't like, but it's almost perverse of me. That Sauvignon, the sort of yellow wine made like sherry it's oxidized. But also the cooking there is great, and it's That's a bit off the beaten track, but not very.
Cassis is on my list, thanks to you. I haven't been there, and you paint a very pretty picture of it.
Well, I mean, I think it's funny, because since I've filmed there, people have said, oh, well, it's very touristy. But compared to the rest of the Mediterranean coast, it's not. And the thing that's so unusual about it, it looks like a Greek sort of island.
That's what got me.
And, you know, like a somewhere like Idra or Naxos, you know, it's like the town there, because it's constricted by, it's down at the end of a valley, and you look, and the harbour is like picture book, you know, with like little, you know, pastel painted fishing boats. And I mean, people say, well, it's all like a show, and it's just they've sold out to tourism, but we had some really nice food there, and you'll always find that, you know, like, you know, people are a bit rude about Saint-Tropez. Most of the cooking around Saint-Tropez is appalling, but there's one or two really good restaurants. Or I like going in Rhodes to Lindos, which is very touristy, very British touristy, but there's still some good cooking there, you know? So it's sort of like hiding in plain sight sort of thing with Cassis.
Dave Gilmore lives there as well. Last question. So Evie Porter on Instagram wants to know about a Christmas pudding that's a little bit different. She says that Christmas pudding is just too old-fashioned.
Well, I got this recipe in Alsace, and actually I was quite pleased to get the recipe, because I think it's this very lovely, very chatty woman that makes fantastic jams called Christine Ferber. She makes this beautiful strawberry jam, which is only just set. She puts a tiny bit of vanilla in it, but her jams sell all over the world. They're probably not as well known in the UK, but she does very well in the States. Christine's father, called Maurice, actually has this recipe called Kugelhopf Glace. Basically, it's an ice cream shaped like a giant savarin, so it's got like a hole in the middle. And it's actually flavoured with all the things in Christmas pudding that you love, like all the currants and all the spice, but it's an ice cream. And it's just delicious. And I was really lucky, because her father's called Maurice, and he very kindly agreed to give us the recipe, and I'm going to use that next time I'm doing Christmas pudding back in the UK, because it tastes like it, but it's just like 10 times easier to eat.
Well, and very Merry Christmas to you, Rick. Thank you very much.
Cheers.
And that's it for the Christmas series. You can find that recipe for Rick's Kugelhopf Glace on Rick's podcast page at deliciousmagazine.co.uk/stories/podcasts. And I'll be back next week with a brand new series, Be a Better Cook for 2020.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.